Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Cokie Roberts, whose new book is Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868. We'll also hear from best-selling author David Baldacci, whose new book is Memory Man, and Rick Barton, author of In the Wake of the Flagship. Distinguished journalist Cokie Roberts is known for her news commentary for ABC News and National Public Radio, and in recent years for her fine literary achievements, particularly in women's history, with such best-selling books as Founding Mothers and Ladies of Liberty. Her new book, just out this month, has the grand title, Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868. Cokie Roberts, it's such a pleasure to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Well, Susan, it's so nice to talk to you.
Now, before we get to the book, I have to say, you're coming to town to receive the 2015 Humanist of the Year Award from the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Now, I know you've won lots of awards before, but does this one hold any little special meaning for you?
Of course it does. actually, I'm coming to Baton Rouge for it.
But that's true.
It is my home state, and it is therefore important, but also a celebration of the humanities is something that we need to do a whole lot more of, and I'm glad that the Louisiana Endowment is on the case and, you know, really active, because it varies from state to state. And having a really on-the-mark, ready-to-promote the humanities organization in my home state is something to celebrate.
Well, so, so well-deserved. So congratulations. But now, the new book, Capital Dames. I love it that we've gone from ladies to dames.
Well, the publisher was just crazed because I didn't have a name for the book. And I was way late anyway on turning it in, so they kept saying to me, if you could just come up with a name, you know, we could sort of calm everybody down for a bit. And I had everybody in the family working on names, and nobody was coming up with one. And I kept playing with Washington, and nothing was working. And then I thought, well, why don't I play with Capital? And the minute I did that, Capital Dames came to mind, and it was just, you know, that was the obvious one for me. Because, of course, it's something of a play on words, you know, that they're not just in the Capital, but they are first rate.
Absolutely. Now, if you ever have a book with broads in the title, I think I worry a lot. You know?
You'll know I've sunk to a new song.
Oh, but one of the things I really love about this book, in addition to these great, great women that you're chronicling, is that it's such a marvelous portrait of a city that you know very well and love very much, at a time of incredible stress in its
right.
existence.
And I really wasn't as aware of that until I started doing the work on the book. I mean, I certainly understood that Washington changes during wars. I had witnessed the result of World War II as a child growing up there, but I had no notion of what danger it was in the Civil War. I mean, if you think about it, of course, it makes sense. Virginia's right across the river, and it was the capital of the country, as the Confederacy styled itself, that was at war with the country that Washington was the capital of. And, of course, for a while, it was not clear whether Maryland would secede. And if it had, Washington really would have been cooked. And even with Maryland staying in the Union, it was a slave state with many Confederate sympathizers. So it was a dangerous position. And there were several times when it looked like the city would be attacked and destroyed. And until there were a series of forts built around it to protect it, it was a very precarious situation.
Well, the other interesting thing is the cast of characters, which is so rich. And they're so vibrant. And you bring home to the reader the fact that these are all people who socialized, who knew each other,
right,
and had complex relationships and friendships.
Well, it was a small town in so many ways, and it was primarily a southern town. And so particularly the wives, sisters, daughters of Southern politicians knew each other well, because often a father and then a son or a nephew would occupy a congressional seat. So they had been there and knew the aunt or the grandmother or whatever. And the local community was also Southern. So there was a lot of people interacting with each other, and then people who would come and stay and get to know anybody who was there became good friends, as one would.
Well, and one of the things you bring home in this book, which of course you would be very sensitive to, is the backbreaking work these women did in terms of their daily lives, just maintaining households, but also as social arbiters, just how hard the work of entertaining was and how important it was.
You know, even when my parents went to Congress, when my father was first elected in 1940, my mother told the stories of going to Washington, and she was 24. Every time I think about it, it's just mind-boggling. But that at that point, before World War II, it was very similar to the way it had been from the time it became the capital in 1800 on, where you had to go calling. And so you called on, like, the cabinet on Monday, the Senate on Tuesday, the House on Wednesday, the court on Thursday, and received on Friday, or something like that. And that was still true when she was a young congressional wife. It was World War II that changed that. So these women really had an obligation to do it, and they used those calls as political campaigns for their husbands, for their parties, for their causes. At one point, in fact, Abigail Brooks Adams, who was the wife of Charles Francis Adams, who was John Quincy Adams' son, and he was in Congress from Massachusetts and then became the Union's ambassador to England and helped keep England from siding with the Confederacy. But she was furious with Charles Sumner, the senator from Massachusetts, who was a friend of hers. And she said, "I gave him a piece of my mind. He expects us all to go out and show ourselves and entertain and work all the time for the cause. And he did nothing, not a thing." So she felt strong. I'm quoting her there.
Yeah.
And she felt strongly that, you know, she was doing her part. She was working.
And so many of these women were writers as well, and it's not like they were all trained to be writers. They just felt that it was their duty, and they wrote for the newspaper all the time.
Well, there were some women who wrote for newspapers because they needed to make a living.
Right.
There were some women who were activists who wrote for newspapers as abolitionist activists or suffragist activists. And then after the war, it was a way that women like Verena Davis could make a living. She would have been poverty-stricken. And she moved to New York, much to the horror of the Confederacy, you know, the first lady of the Confederacy going to that Yankee city. But that was where she could work for the New York World and make a living. But she also was eager to do that. She was eager to become her own person. And she had always been somewhat suspect. It's interesting. She and Mary Lincoln had a lot of parallels in terms of how other women viewed them. Mary Lincoln was considered a Southern sympathizer. Verena Davis was considered a Northern sympathizer because her grandfather had been governor of New Jersey, and she had gone to school in Philadelphia. And she was olive-complected. She was not the fair Southern belle of fame and the kind of looks that people appreciated in the South at the time. And she wrote to her daughter when she moved to New York, she said, "I'm free, brown, and 64, and I can do whatever I want to do."
I love that. Oh, goodness. Cokey, it's just a fascinating book, and I just loved it. So I'm excited for everyone to read it.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Cokey Roberts, whose wonderful new book is Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868. The night of April 23rd, she'll be receiving the Humanist of the Year Award at the Louisiana State Museum in Baton Rouge, and you can meet her in New Orleans Friday, April 24th at 10 at Ben Franklin High School in the auditorium. Cokey, congratulations, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. Such a treat to be with you.
It's a great pleasure to speak with David Baldacci, one of America's best-selling authors. He practiced law for 9 years, but starting with his debut novel, Absolute Power, published in 1996, he took a different path, and legions of readers are grateful and loyal followers. This month, he's celebrating the release of his 30th book for adults. It's called Memory Man. David, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
Thank you. First of all, congratulations. 30 books. That's a landmark.
It is. You know, for many years, I didn't think I was even going to have one. So it's quite an achievement.
Well, I'm so curious because you had a bestseller right out of the gate, which is a great confidence builder for any writer. So as you've gone along, have you set goals for your work to write better or different characters or more elaborate plots or branch out in subject matter? How have you set those goals for yourself?
You know, so many occupations in life, people get better at something by doing the same thing over and over again, a surgeon or a pilot. I flew in today, and, you know, I was on a plane with a pilot. I wouldn't want to be on the plane, and the pilot said, you know what, I've flown this sucker the same way for 20 years. Today, I'm going to try something different. Not want to be a passenger on that plane. But I think writers need to get out of their comfort zone, try different things, challenge themselves, scare themselves sometimes doing something different in order to get better. I think if you don't stretch, you sort of wither. It's such a creative process that you could easily slump into formula. And I think what I try to do over the years is write different series, very different types of characters. It allows me to give an evolution of those characters over multiple books, but I get to write about very different people. And I venture out into different locations, different geography, different places around the world, and it also sort of takes me out of my comfort zone and makes me really inhabit those characters' skins and go and see those places. So it's just trying something different.
And you've also written books for young readers. What inspired that?
Well, as a kid, I loved fantasy. And really, that's what got me into reading, and reading is what got me into writing. And fantasy is the ultimate sort of liberty for a writer, because you make everything up from the ground up. In my thrillers, I have to tie everything and tether it to the real world if I'm writing about the FBI, the Secret Service. Those have to be well-researched. But with fantasy, you can just write anything you want and let your imaginations just rip. And I was just a little kid again telling stories. It was a wonderful experience.
So your new book, Memory Man, is just amazing. Now, I read it in a single sitting, and I'm very lucky I have a job that lets me do that. But I suspect readers are going to find it very difficult to put down. So to set the scene for us with this new character, Amos Decker, he's so unusual.
He is. I've never written a character like him before. He's an ex-football player. He lasted one professional play. He suffered a traumatic brain injury, and because of that, he acquired the ability of hyperthymesia, which means he really can't forget anything. And that sounds like it would be a blessing, a benefit, but it also comes with a curse as well, because lots of us have things we would like to forget. So he has this amazing mind. He goes into police work, becomes a detective. He's extraordinary at it, because really what happened to his mind also allows him to see the world in a very different way. He sees things in most of us just sort of blissfully overlook and don't even consider. And as he says in the book, it's small things lead to really big discoveries. Mm-hmm. And his family is murdered. One night he comes home as a detective, and the case is never solved. And about a year and a half later, after his life has tumbled out of control, he's gone through bouts of homelessness, and now he's sort of rebuilt his life somewhat. Someone walks into the police and confesses to the crime, and really that's where the story just takes off from there. But I loved writing this guy's character. He was so different, so new, so fresh. I like ran to my computer every morning to sit down and just, you know, hook up with Amos for a while.
Well, it's so interesting because we meet him on the very worst night of his life. And so you're so willing to root for this damaged character all the way through.
That was important for me because he is difficult at times. His social cues and abilities really were damaged because of what happened to his brain. He was given sort of superhuman mental ability, but other things were taken away that most of us take for granted, and we spend a lot of time on, you know, gossip and venting and just junk that he no longer can relate to, humor, empathy, and sympathy. So it was a mixed bag for him, but I did want people to root for him and also understand his eccentricities and understand that he's not saying that what happened to him has destroyed his life. It's just made him different. And in the book, one character says, wow, it must be really cool to have such a great mind now. And he says, well, do you like who you are? And she says, yes, I do. And he said, well, I liked who I was, too. I'm no longer a person.
That was very moving, that moment, I thought. So did you do lots of research about memory and brain stuff while you were writing this book?
I did. I'm fascinated by that. And the brain is the most powerful tool any of us will ever have. And it can make us do things or not do things to an extraordinary level. If you think about someone who has an OCD or someone who has a phobia about flying or talking in front of people, the brain dominates us and won't let us build outside of that wall. It's like we're, you know, closeted in this place we can't break out of, even though there's nothing holding us in. It's all mental. But it's so powerful. And I thought to have someone who's really is entrapped inside this enormous mental brain, how can you really deal with that? How can he ever sort of get away from it? So I did a lot of research on hyperthymesia, people who also see numbers and color, people who have had traumatic brain injuries and come out of that. You know, one guy had an injury, came out of it speaking fluent French, even though he'd never spoken French in his life. It's just, it's amazing what's up there that's never unlocked in most people. So I wanted to explore a story where one guy really got a lot unlocked.
Well, and in addition to this, you know, kind of mental change in his life, he's also become like a shell of his former physical self. He's let himself go. He doesn't look well. He's gained a lot of weight. And it's rare that we see a male character kind of reckoning with that kind of change, to have gone from such a powerful, athletic person to just this wreck, shambling wreck of a guy, you know?
And that was very different for me, too. Most of my characters, the male characters, are pretty fit. They're either in the military or they work for an agency. So to have a guy who, as I said, he has two meat sticks for legs and a blimp for a belly, it made people not focus really on the physical so much. You focused on the mind and who that person was inside, not necessarily on the outside. And it allowed him to sort of be who he was and also be really out of the mainstream. Doesn't really care what he looks like. Doesn't really care that he's really out of shape and overweight. It allowed for sort of a few comedic moments as well in the book, where there was one when his old partner said, "Do you want to go outside and smoke with me?" And he said, "Look, I can smoke or I can be fat. I can't do both."
It'll be interesting to see what actors line up to play this role, too.
They won't have to diet for the role, I can tell you that.
Right. Oh, now, like many successful writers, you've supported causes close to your heart. And recently, you were the chair of National Library Week, and thank you for doing that.
Yes.
I'd love to hear more about the ongoing work of your Wish You Well Foundation.
Our focus and goal and mission is to eradicate illiteracy in the United States, and it's a huge problem and really is at the foundation of all of our social and economic ills, and the fact that people can't read or can't read well enough. And we have 100 million adults in this country who read at the two lowest levels of literacy. It's not an ESL problem. It's a lot of different problems. It's not an urban, rural, or suburban problem. It's a nationwide problem. And if you can't read, then you really can't think. We're an information society, so how in the world can you make informed decisions about anything, pursue a job that will realize your potential, if you can't have that one fundamental skill you need? So we fund programs all over the country. We fund in programs, you know, north, south, east, and west, small organizations, large organizations. We're trying to give them the tools to help people learn how to read at a very high level. And I think if we can accomplish that, then most of the problems we face as a nation just simply go away.
Oh, I think you're right. And you're asking people to bring book donations to your book signings on this tour as well.
We have an organization as part of the Wish You Well Foundation called Feeding Body and Mind, and we hooked up with Feeding America, which runs all the nation's food banks. So we piggyback on their distribution system, so we just feed them books, and they take those books, and people going in to seek food assistance also largely have low literacy skills. So they go home not only with food, which they need to survive, obviously, they go home with books and to gain reading skills, which can literally change their lives. That's our goal. And over the last 4 years, we've shipped out over 1 million books across the country, and we'll continue that effort.
Ah, that's a great thing to do. Well, we've been talking with best-selling author David Baldacci, whose new book is Memory Man. You can meet him Tuesday, April 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Rip Barton is the director of the Creative Writing Workshop and a research professor of English here at the University of New Orleans. He's the author of many novels, including Courting Pandemonium, Black and White on the Rocks, and A House Divided. His first novel, The El Cholo Feeling Passes, was published in 1985, and now he's back with a sequel to that novel, In the Wake of the Flagship. Rick, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, Susan. Great to see you.
You too. So, this is what you've been doing for the last many, many years, 588 pages.
Yes, I have been working on a book for a while.
Yes. So, why was the time right for you to go back to this character and to finally finish this book?
Well, you know, when you start off with a first novel that's sort of a coming-of-age novel, you get the character only to a certain place, and I did. He made a decision about what not to do with his life, but not so much about what to do with his life, so I've been wondering about him for ages. He was headed toward a basketball coaching career at the end of El Cholo Feeling Passes, and I wondered if he stayed with that. And I found out in writing In the Wake of the Flagship that he didn't, although
right.
Maybe that wasn't the right choice, or maybe it was.
Well, it's really two novels in one. It's such an amazing experience to read because you are flashing back and forth between time periods, characters. I mean, it's really kind of a rich and full book in that way.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to try to argue that it's not really two novels, but it certainly moves between 17th century New England and the 21st century Gulf Coast. It moves between war, between the New England settlers and the Native American people they find on those shores, and the aftermath of a great hurricane, sort of Katrina-like in our 10th anniversary after Katrina. And the impact of that great hurricane, particularly on an urban public higher education institution and what that institution means to the city, to its students, and how the people who work there fight to save it.
You were very involved in the comeback of UNO right after. I mean, I remember when you thought of the Voices Rising project and started collecting oral histories and sensing the stories that were possible during Katrina. So what was it like to turn this into fiction? Was it cathartic? Was it difficult? Did you worry that you were telling too much of the truth or not enough?
Well, I think from the moment that the storm blew away, and here in New Orleans or in Baton Rouge or wherever we were, I realized, as many of my writing colleagues, that there was tremendous story material in the aftermath of this storm. In the immediate aftermath of the storm, I was the provost at the University of New Orleans. My time was filled up, you know, sort of cliche, 24/7. And I looked around as colleagues like John Biganay wrote a great play about that experience, as Tom Piazza wrote a wonderful novel, City of Refuge, about that experience. And I simply didn't have access to my own time during that period. So I got started on trying to express my angle on the aftermath of that storm a while later. And this is the product of that. But it was always in there germinating from the very beginning. And that's why I started the Voices Rising project, because I didn't want to lose any stories that we could possibly save.
So you've been in academe for as long as I've known you, and that's a long time. So what are the challenges of turning that environment into fiction?
Well, I think all we have to do is look at some of our great writers out there and books about the academic life that they've produced. Jane Smiley, Moo, Richard Russo, Straight Man, Michael Chabon, Wonder Boys, and on and on and on. One that's not as well known is John Williams Stoner, which is a novel about an English teacher at a school. He doesn't publish much, and we sort of tend to think that his life has been wasted. Sometimes he thinks that, but I think ultimately the calling to teach and to work with students and to appreciate particular academic subjects is powerful material. And that's the reason writers have turned to it so often. Mm-hmm. In this particular case, I think the story of what urban institutions like the University of New Orleans or like Urban University, as I call it in this novel, are so important to the communities that they serve. And I also think they're underappreciated and sometimes unappreciated. And this novel tries to call attention to how important they are.
It's so interesting to me, the tone you strike in this book, because in the section set during King Philip's War, for example, there's some really bloody, terrible stuff happening. But there's also this wicked political humor. And the same thing with the hurricane sections at Urban University. You have that black gallows humor that was so prevalent here then. But then you have like this real earnest human despair. And you capture some of those moments with Rich and his wife, Kelly, who are both involved with Urban University. And just that sheer moment when they recognize the magnitude of their loss. And you hit all those feelings so well. I mean, it's just such a good range of emotional experiences for a reader. So what was that like for you as a writer? Were you up and down with this book? How were you when you were writing it?
I guess I'm always looking for the humor in things. In the 17th century part of the story, as Metacomb and his Wampanoag people try simply to survive, there's not a lot of humor in the day-to-day. But Metacomb himself, who tells the story, both halves of the story in this book, you know, he's a human being, and humor is one of the great blessings that the Creator has given to us, and Metacomb has it.
He has
a very, you know, sardonic way of looking at life and recognizing that we should seize humor where we can find it. So I guess that expresses my own attitude, that even in the midst of terrible things that happen to us, we ought to try to find places to laugh at it.
Mm-hmm. And try to rise to the occasion, as always. Well, we've been talking with Rick Barton, whose new book is In the Wake of the Flagship. You can meet him Thursday, April 23rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Rick, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, David Baldacci, signs Memory Man, his 30th novel for adults, Tuesday, April 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Steve Beisner, writer, musician, and computer scientist, discusses new software useful to writers, Tuesday, April 21st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. This is the meeting of the Women's National Book Association of New Orleans, but all are welcome. Gay Leonhardt signs Shaking Up Prohibition in New Orleans, a guide to vintage cocktails from A to Z, Wednesday, April 22nd at 6 at Octavia Books. Poets Joel Daly, author of Industrial Loop, and Bill Lavender, author of Memory Wing, read their work Wednesday, April 22nd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. National Book Award-winning novelist Kimberly Willis signs her new book for young readers Dear Hank Williams, Thursday, April 23rd at 4:30 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Rick Barton, signs In the Wake of the Flagship, Thursday, April 23rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Gary Stewart discusses and signs The Most Dangerous Animal of All, Searching for My Father and Finding the Zodiac Killer, Thursday, April 23rd at 7 at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, Cokie Roberts, discusses and signs Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868, Friday, April 24th at 10 a.m. at the Ben Franklin High School Auditorium. To reserve a seat, go to bfhsla.org. And the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival is coming up. Look for these authors at the book tent next to the CD tent at the fairgrounds. It's run by the New Orleans Gulf South Booksellers Association, and proceeds go to literacy programs. Here's who's signing. Friday, April 24th, from 2 to 3, Laura Lane McNeil. From 3 to 4, Tom Cooper. From 4 to 5, Bruce Sunpie Barnes and Rachel Brenlin. Saturday, April 25th, from noon to 1, Chantel Carter Frank. From 3 to 4, Keith Welded Medley. From 4 to 5, Patrice Joseph. And from 5 to 6, Don Chartier. Sunday, April 26th, from 1 to 2, Barry Bronston. From 3 to 4, Ashley Kahn. And from 4 to 5, Courtney Mason. And in bookstore news, Emily Lemmy's art and design bookstore, May Books, is now called The Stacks. In addition to their Marigny location at 2402 Royal Street, there's a new location in Central City at 1618 Aretha Castle Haley, inside Church Alley Coffee Bar. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening, and keep reading.